Denny's burnt bird. I'm an alcoholic. I'm not anal retentive, but I just have to have everything just right, you know, just kind of stay in the way I want. Really appreciate being asked to come and talk. It's always a privilege to be in AA meeting. It's always an honor to be asked to talk. I got to tell you, I love an awful lot of people down here in South Georgia, in Georgia in general, but certainly South Georgia. And I know you love me or you wouldn't have asked me to come and talk. But I got to tell you how much I love y'all. Last time I was here was 1988. That's the week of Roundup. And I got on that popcorn plane to go back to Atlanta. And that sucker went like a cork, up and down, all the way back. And I said, God, I'm not going to make a deal with you. But if this plane lands and I'm still alive, I'm never getting back on this SOB again under any circumstances. But I wanted to be with y'all so much, I got on that plane. And I'm telling you, I really did. And for many of you who know my wife, she sends her best. She loves some of y'all as much as I do. There are at least three people, and I know three people in particular in this room, that at 9 years in sobriety saved my ass. Because I was hell-bent for leather to destroy myself. It's not the first time I ever did it, but I was hell-bent for leather to do it sober. But thanks to the grace of God that was delivered to me through this program, I was able to go sit with them, and some sanity came back in my life. And I guess I'd go just about anywhere in the world to be with those people, and a number of you have come to know that I'd go just about anywhere to be with y'all, too. So it's good to be here. Ennis and Matty Lou have been delightful. Talking to Matty Lou talking to Ennis on the phone was always fun. Talking to Matty Lou is just a joy. I mean, it's just a joy. She just tells me things that I haven't heard since I was a redneck in West Kentucky. I mean, y'all may not consider yourselves rednecks, and you may not be, but I'm a redneck from West Kentucky, and I sure do sound a lot like y'all, and sure do think a lot like y'all, so y'all may be rednecks, too. But she told me something I'd forgotten. And have y'all ever heard this expression? That we were talking about getting rid of a crowing hen. She said about her daddy told her to get rid of this hen. The hen was crowing, and she said, a whistling woman and a growing hen will never come to any good end. And I have never heard that before. Oh, I hadn't heard it since I was a kid growing up. I've never dated a whistling woman, and I don't know much about crowing hens. But I just love the way she said it, so I feel good. You know, around Louisville, I'm still considered kind of a misfit because I still talk in those redneck parables, and they just think I'm the greatest thing that ever came up there to Louisville because I'm so cute, you know, and because I have all those wonderful, wonderful things that I say. It was good, and I appreciate Sissy calling me, and we had a long conversation on the phone. Bless her heart, we met last night for the first time, and I told her, I said, if I'd seen what you look like, I'd sure as hell have listened a little closer to what you were saying, you know. But we had a wonderful conversation, and I just don't remember it. That's meant to be an absolute appreciation for beauty, not a chauvinist statement. I need to tell you that, okay? It's good to be here. For the next few minutes, y'all have asked me to share with you my journey. It's a wonderful journey. Before I get into that, let me talk about the speakers a minute. I want to tell something about Delmar, too. I forgot to tell about Delmar. Delmar called me and said, Burns, I want you to be here. And I said, I can't make it to Friday. And he said, I can't make it to 3 o'clock Friday afternoon. And he said, well, so I wish you could come earlier because we need you at the Friday night supper. And I said, okay, I'll be there. So I've made all my arrangements, called him back, and I said, I got to leave at 8 o'clock Sunday morning. He said, well, we'd sure appreciate it if you'd stay for a Sunday morning speaker. I said, well, if I stay for a Sunday morning speaker, it's going to cost you $250 more because that's the plane fare. He said, we sure are going to enjoy having you in there on Saturday night, you know. So I found out where his money, you know, and the speakers that have been here, I've not heard Jay and I've not heard Dennis. I'll get to tape and hear them. I have heard the rest of the speakers, and I'm truly, honestly, humbly awed to be included in it. I don't think I'm chopped liver, but I'll tell you what, I'm in with a bunch of heavy-duty people. And looking around and seeing some of the other speakers that I've met traveling around the country, it's just, I'm just always kind of odd that my story attracts that much attention. But if it does, it does, because for sure there's somebody in this audience that needs to hear it. And I don't know who you are. I really don't know who you are. I know I need to hear it, but there's more than just me. And I've been blessed today to have two or three people come up and tell me things that I've said at various places I've been that were very significant in their lives. And I'm sure it'll be someone in this audience that'll be significant to. Again, it won't necessarily be significant to all of you, because recovery is various planes of spirituality. And I may be on a plane where some of you are not today. Or maybe some of you are on another plane, and you'll say, damn, I'll be glad when he gets here, instead of flying around. And there'll be others who'll say, I'll be glad when I get to where he is. And then there'll be some of you who say, and just walk out and forget the whole damn deal. And that's all right. Keep coming back and listen to the tape, and it'll be level. For the next few minutes, you've asked me to share my experience and strength and hope with you, to share my life with you, to share with you the things that turned me around, to share with you the things that made me what I am, and share with you the things I had to overcome, and the grace of God delivered to me through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that allowed me to do that. I will not leave anything out in that story. Some of the things I will not be able to tell because time will not allow. I know it's taken everything that has ever happened in my life for me to be here. And for me to arbitrarily omit some of that story simply because there's been a man-made decree that I would leave parts of that story out, I will not do. We are told in the big book in the family afterwards that our greatest asset is our experience, for with it we may be able to help another alcoholic. And I'm not going to leave any parts of it out just simply because there may be something you need to hear. And I know sure as hell there's something I need to hear. So I will try to tell you that as best I can. About a year ago, I listened to a tape. It was a tape of Bill Wilson talking after Dr. Bob died. It was very powerful to me because as I listened to that tape, what overcame me was a deep sense of gratitude. That Bill Wilson turned right and went and looked at the ledger for the church, he was rather than turning left and going in the bar. Because he turned right and went to the church ledger, we're here tonight, relatively safe, reasonably calm, and certainly grateful to be together. I can walk out of my door in Louisville, Kentucky, and within 10 minutes I can be in a meeting. 435 of them every week in the city of Louisville. And I have a tendency to take that for granted because they've always been there. But because of the sacrifice of one man, when God tapped him, and that's what I choose to believe, when God tapped him, he turned right. It's also an interesting phenomenon that in that, if you read that part of the book, in this particular area, it's a vision for you. I'm fascinated with this. Because I'm fascinated with the whole program of Alcoholics Anonymous. There was a wonderful man in Louisville, Kentucky named Charlie Robertson who's now dead. And Charlie was probably one of the most spiritual people I've ever known. And the reason I felt he was spiritual is because this man was a thief. His whole demeanor, his whole attitude, he was a thief. Charlie always talked like he had a mouthful of mush and a head full of Valium. He died at about 27 years of sobriety, and Charlie was always talking like that. He came up to me, that first 5 years as I get to it, you'll know I was goofy and a goat. He would come up to me and he'd put his arm around me and say, hey, Barnes, you find this program fascinating? I'd say, well, yeah, Charlie, I do. And he'd say, that's good, because them that don't think it's fascinating seem to get drunk a lot. And then he'd turn around and walk off. And I'd say, who was that masked man, you know? But I find this program fascinating about some things, and I always love to hear speakers talk because I can always tell when they're sharing their opinion, strength, and hope, and when they're sharing their experience, strength, and hope. And a lot of times tonight, I'll get to preaching and teaching. I don't set out to do that. It just ends up that way sometimes. You know, all alcoholics, we don't have opinions on things, but we draw strong conclusions. So during this process, there are going to be a lot of strong conclusions. And you get the point where you say, hey, he's preaching and teaching. Just go with it. Hell, it may be worth listening to for all you know. But one of the things that impressed me about Wilson at that time is he was getting ready to turn right rather than left. You know what his thought was? Read it. His thought was, what about all those alcoholics who won't get the message? at the moment of truth, God allowed him to overcome his self-centeredness to think of us. Isn't that neat? He didn't think about, I need to deal with my issues. I don't have any problem with dealing with issues. I really don't, God. I'm dealing with them every day. It's called my head. I'm dealing with my issues. But at that moment of truth, what he thought of was us. You know? So he turned right. And that gratitude just pours over me. As the gratitude is poured over me, what I'm beginning to feel with increasing power and conviction and absolute almost obsession is the responsibility that I'm beginning to feel for the message that the newcomer is going to hear. In Bill Wilson's last talk, which you can read in almost any of our walls, it says two things he talked about in that last. He's too sick to give it. Lois read it, but it's real clear. One thing he said was anonymity would always be absolutely essential. He believed it at the time of his death more than he ever believed it before, and he believed it from the beginning. Had a couple of hitches in there, but he came to know that it was absolutely essential. The other thing he said was AA must and will change. When I looked at that, I thought, what in the name of God does that mean? Are we going to get 17 steps rather than 12? Or what are we going to do with all this stuff, you know? I figured the only way to find out was to ask somebody who'd been around for a long, long time. So I called Geraldine D. up in New Jersey, and I said, Ms. D., I said, has AA changed since you came in? She said, yes. I said, how has it changed? She said, when I came in, there were probably 10 or 12 old-timers for every newcomer. Today, there are probably 30 or 40 newcomers for every old-timer. I said, is that bad? And she said, I don't know if it's bad. It's a fact. I said, how are we going to handle this? And she said, we're going to have to remain pure with the principles and teach them as they were given us. Because we're going to run into more and more opinions, because we're going to be having people 1, 2, and 3 years of sobriety sponsor newcomers. And that's not a, there's nothing wrong with that. Except when I was 1, 2, and 3 years sober, I was lucky to find the fly on my pants and the commode to dump it in, you know? I'm very serious. What is that newcomer going to hear? What is that message? What are we going to have this newcomer hear? More and more I'm hearing things in meetings like, I was sitting in a meeting not too long ago, and there was a fellow there with 15 years sobriety. He said, I have this terrible resentment. And he went through the whole resentment. It was reasonable resentment. He probably should have been a little bit leaked off about the whole deal. But somebody said, how are you going to deal with it? And he said, well, I've got this oak tree behind my house, and I'm going to go out there, and I'm going to run around that oak tree, and I do it every time I get a resentment, 15, 20, 30 times. I just fall down so tired, and my resentment's better, and I go in and I go to sleep. So what about the next morning? He said, oh, it's always back. So what are you doing? I go back down and I get around that oak tree and I run around that oak tree and I get the damn time. I thought, that son of a bitch don't kill himself running around that oak tree, yeah? And I thought to myself, what he needs is another 12-step program called Oak Trees Anonymous. That's what he needs. And then about a week later, I'm sitting in a meeting. This guy had a resentment and he was just carrying on about it. Somebody said, what are you going to do about it? And he said, well, I do what I always do. I'm going to get down and write this letter. And I'm going to send this letter to this guy that I hate. And I'm going to tell him everything he's done to me, every reason I hate him, why I hate him. And then I'm going to I'll mail it to him, and I'll feel better. So I said, well, is that the way the program works? And he said, my therapist says that if I'm going to have any self-esteem, I've got to not let them walk on me. So I don't have any problem with that principle. It's just not Alcoholics Anonymous. And a newcomer sitting in that meeting thinks, I need to move in a house with an oak tree and write me a damn letter telling everybody I hate their guts. And see, that's not Alcoholics Anonymous. I sat in a meeting not too long ago, and I listened to a guy, and we were talking about the four step, and this guy said, I don't know what the hell y'all are all fired up about. He said, I've been in AA 24 years, and I've never read the book, and I've never done a fourth step. And look at me. And I thought, boy, are you sure as hell I need to look at you? You got everything I want. And here's this newcomer said, after I get through with the oak tree and writing that letter, I better be damn sure I don't read that book and do a fourth step, because he's got 24 years to write. This is amusing, but you hear it? There's somebody sitting in this room tonight who's a newcomer, and what's that message that newcomer is going to hear? Because that newcomer, when they plant us, when we ain't nothing but raising posies, is going to be the one that's going to determine if AA is here or not and exactly what it's going to be about. You know, and I've got both kids of mine. One daughter been in AA 14 years, and one son been in 10 years, and I got grandkids that are going to be coming along, and all they got to do is walk past the bar, and they're going to be a drunk. And I'm going to tell you they are, because Ever Brady's always a drunk when they walk past. They don't have to take a drink. They just got to walk by the damn bar. And by the time they get to the corner, they need to come to AA. And my prayer is when they get here, it's going to be that same pure thing that prompted Bill Wilson to stand at that corner and say, what about those drunks who will never hear the message? And the message is going to hear. See, when I came in AA, I came in AA in 1977. And I came in at the end of what I call the dark ages of Alcoholics Anonymous. There seemed to be an era in there where the whole message was, don't drink, go to meetings, get a sponsor, tell him everything that's wrong with you. He'll tell you what to do about it, and then go save a drunk. And that's what I heard. And when I came in here, I wired the first three steps in a heartbeat. And I wired one-third of the 12th step in a heartbeat. So I had a 3 1/3 step program. And I was lethal. I mean, I ran around saving drunks. The word was, here comes Burns Brady, and if you haven't had a drink, he'll give you a beer and take you to treatment. Because by God, he's dedicated. And I mean, I was just ears laid back, hell bent for leather. I mean, I was a lethal weapon for God. That's exactly what I was. I mean, Ted, you, I couldn't stir shit with a spoon. I was Yes, sir. I was everywhere. And I got to tell you, two things kept me sober. Two things absolutely kept me sober. The first was I was absolutely committed to the first half of the first step. I mean, tell you, whiskey whipped my butt big time. It left me no slack. It took everything out of me, my heart, my soul, my feelings, my gut, everything. Alcohol whipped me. It didn't work for me. If it still worked, I'd probably still be drinking it. I'm one of the fortunate people that whiskey whipped, because I've never had to doubt it. I've never had for a minute to think that I could drink it. Oh, I'd sit and thought, I'm really angry because I can't have a drink. I'm really angry that I can't drink like a normal person, but I've never doubted that I can't drink like a normal person. I can't. Don't even have to worry about it. And the other thing that kept me sober was working the drunk. It kept me out of my own self-centeredness. It kept me from sitting around and dealing with this thing between my ears, you know. It kept me moving. But I began to notice something about 8 years in the program. A lot of these people that I dragged off the treatment were beginning to make sense. They didn't stay around me long, but they were starting to make sense. And I wasn't making any sense. And driven to my knees by a series of circumstances that those three people in this room know intimately and held my hand and prayed with me. Driven to my knees, I became a student of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I read it. I did it. And it was mine. And today I've got a 12-step program as opposed to a 3 1/3 step program. And I got to tell you, the difference is daylight and dark. I'm still crazy, but on a daily basis, I've got a process that Don talked about today, a process to utilize to deal with that insanity that is the human condition that is complicated in my mind with alcoholism. Now, let me make this statement before I go any further. I want to be sure nobody hears anything different. If you're an alcoholic of my type, you'll never be able to drink and drug like a normal person, okay? I need you to hear that. You'll never be able to drink and drug like a normal person if you're an alcoholic of my type. But interestingly enough, when I read that book, it told me that alcohol was not my problem. It said alcohol is only a symptom, and the bottle is only a symbol. I thought, well, by God, how can they say that? I got put in jail, cost me my marriage, got me kicked out of medical school. I could go on with all the litany of stuff. Somebody said, no, Vern, it caused you those problems. Your problems, your mind. Big Book calls it a peculiar mental twist. Isn't that wonderful? A peculiar mental twist. The way I think. When I first came in, they told me, if you stop the drinking and don't deal with the thinking, you're going to go back to the drinking. You know, mental health says alcohol is only a symptom. AA says alcohol is only a symptom. The difference between the two of us, they say, if you clear up your thinking, you can go back to the drinking. AA says you clear up the thinking and you won't want to go back to the drinking. Yeah? And if you don't clear up the thinking, you're going to want to go back to the drinking. Because we ain't stupid. You run an IQ on this room, and it's going to be above average. And when we're sitting around like I sit around and hurt like hell, I'm going to get some relief. And I'm going to get relief wherever it will work. You think I'm going to stand there and drive bamboo spikes under my nails just so I can sit there and say, I'm a tough son of a bitch? No. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to find some relief. It's probably going to be not alcohol, because that won't work. Not drugs, because that quit working too. Be in the wrong bed. It'll be working my butt off when I could be home. It'll be traveling 50 weeks a year, talking at AA conferences rather than staying home and being with some of my people some of the time, mainly my wife. She's really good. She's really grateful that I have this wonderful AA talk. She'd really like to see my burns every now and then, too, you know, and sometimes she doesn't get to travel with me. All of that deal that goes on. I was down. Let me tell you about the peculiar mental twist. I was out in East Texas, and I was talking at a conference, and there was a fellow that was voiced at the conference, been sober about 40 years, about 85 years old. He was wonderful. He talked like he had a flat brainwave, but if you listen to this guy, he was really funny. And I sat in there, he told this wonderful story, and this is the peculiar mental twist. This is the alcoholic peculiar mental twist. There was this guy that circuit rode all over East Texas. He was a traveling salesman. He'd check into motels, motel stay a week, check in the next motel, stay a week. And he was what we call in West Kentucky bad to drink. So he'd check in the motel and go out and get drunk, and they'd fit him, set up the room like they always did when he came back in. Well, this particular night, he'd had all this fun he could take, so he went home, got into AA, went to 28-day treatment program. Hell, I don't know where he went. Anyway, he got straight. He came back, circuit riding again, checked into this motel, went out that night to go to an AA meeting. They set the room up like they normally did. He came in, opened the door, switched on the light, and right beside the bed, there's a fifth of whiskey and a bucket of ice. And on the foot of the bed, there are these two beautiful women. He sat there and looked at that scene a minute. He said, well, said, I've started going to AA and asked them what I had to do to stay sober, feel good about myself. And he said, I had to quit drinking and change everything I'm doing. So I can't drink that whiskey. And one of you girls is going to have to leave. See, that's the peculiar mental twist. I had a woman come up to me one time when I was talking, told that story, and she said, that's a chauvinist joke. And I said, of course it's a chauvinist joke. It's about a male alcoholic, and every male alcoholic coming into AA is a chauvinist. Our job is to quit being one. We don't even know it half the time. But the deal is, it shows the peculiar mental twist. That peculiar mental twist manifested in me comes out in three ways. You can nail it. First way is terminal uniqueness. I can live by a different set of rules. I can live by a different set of rules. I know it's 65 mile an hour speed zone, but if I get started a little late, I can drive 95. You shouldn't do that, because that's dangerous. I can park in handicapped parking areas because I'm only going to be there for 5 minutes. My feeling about the IRS is they're going to screw me, so I need to get there first. This deal of I can live by a different set of rules. It fascinates me on a daily basis to watch my mind believe I can live with a different set of rules. Affairs of the heart. I know you shouldn't even think about having an affair. Or if you do, at least start working on it. But I didn't think it was anything I shouldn't do. Because I had such a program and believed in God so strongly that it wouldn't matter. A different set of rules. What I call this wonderful disease of delusion, and that's the delusion of immunity. They believe I'm immune from your rules. And they're rules. Silkworth said, rules. And they're rules. The second way that this peculiar mental twist presents in me is victimization. Because of them, I'm this way. And it started way back early on, like, yeah, I was born poor. I had to belong to the country club. I had to caddy at the country club. I couldn't belong. What do you expect of me? Then with my wife, when I was drinking, well, if you were married to my wife, you'd drink too. And then if the medical community really knew how smart I was, they wouldn't have kicked me out of medical school. Supreme victimization, right down the line. Now, if the board of licensure would only do what I'm telling them to do, we'd have all these doctors being treated better that want to get into recovery. What's wrong with those idiots? See, now, Wilson knew that we wouldn't understand victimization. Nor would we understand that. We're even a little bit amazed that it happened, aren't we? But we're not pissed, are we? No. Because we have this wonderful program that allows us to deal with things like that. And we're grateful that it's not the drums rolling. Wilson knew we wouldn't understand victimization. That's a therapeutic word, but I tell you what he knew we would understand. What was it? Resentment, isn't it? We would understand resentment. At least I would understand resentment. Victimization, I don't understand. I'd understand it, and I understand it very well. My latest area of victimization is my health. My last 2 years have been miserable from a physical standpoint. Nearly died with a heart attack. Multiple problems with my pancreas, my stomach. And they're still recurring. And I begin to be a victim of my health. Even subtly, and what I was pissed that I had to acknowledge the limitations that I had because I do not want to acknowledge limitations, and I was angry and can still get angry in a heartbeat, but you've given me a program that for this day I can deal with it. I don't know if I can deal with it tomorrow. And I didn't do too bad a job yesterday. But my job is to deal with it today. To deal with that resentment of victimization. I wish I'd been here to hear Dennis talk. Because I heard from some of the people what a beautiful job he did to deal with issues involving black and white. And if there's ever going to be a source of resolution for what is incredibly creeping in on this country as a resolution for this particular issue, it may come from Alcoholics Anonymous. Because we're taught to love, not hate. We're taught to share, not take. We're taught we're brothers and sisters, not adversaries. And we're taught to feel safe with each other in the loving arms of our God. And that's what happened. Wilson gave us this wonderful journey of how to deal with resentment. So that we wouldn't get drunk over being victimized. And let me tell you, when that kid, that child, gets molested sexually, and that isn't dealt with, it will almost always invariably block recovery. To teach that child how to successfully deal with that supreme victimization and the anger and the shame that occurs with it. Final way my peculiar mental twist presents is in the second half of the first step. The manageability of life. The ultimate drunk. People used to come in the program when
I was early, and I'd look around at one of the old timers, and I'd say, so-and-so had a relapse last night. And he said, no, they drank last night. They had a relapse about 6 months ago. I said, well, why did they drink? And he said, because they hadn't accepted the first step. And I used to think they were talking about the first half of the first step. No, they hadn't dealt with the second half of the first step. Almost everybody I've ever dealt with that relapses knows they're powerless over alcohol and drugs. What they can't reconcile is that they are not able to manage life. Every single obsession, every single projection, every single fear, every single thing that dominates my life on a daily basis, and about 90% of this is what's caused my health problem, is my almost terminal battle with trying to fit square pegs in round holes and believing the only way to do it if they don't fit is get a bigger hammer. And the pain that comes from trying to manage life, and every alcoholic, and I've been privileged to work with thousands, God has been good to me. Street people, doctors, lawyers, all points in between. And the ultimate conflict is who's in charge. And what I found is the foundation of what Wilson would talk about that was fear. Every single day, living in fear. Which would mean a power greater than me would have to restore me to sanity. And how to make that practical was what AA brought me. Church taught me that years before, but AA brought it into practicality. I've only found one resolution to those three parts of the peculiar mental twist. And if you think I'm a big book thumper, I hope everybody that leaves this room and says, boy, that guy was a big book thumper. I hope that God can say that about me. I really hope you are. I really hope you are. That peculiar mental twist, and the only way to deal with it is spiritual. And spirituality to me means surrender. And my whole journey of recovery has been surrendering. And I'm not talking about chicken crap compliance. I'm talking about surrendering. I surrendered to my powerlessness over alcohol. I surrendered to a man sending me to treatment. I surrendered to the treatment center. I surrendered to my sponsor. I surrendered to going to meetings. I surrendered to going into therapy. I surrendered to a power greater than me at almost every level as I've gone along. Reluctantly, perhaps, but I've always surrendered. And eventually today, I'm surrendering because of a process I do every day. That means I can surrender before I bleed. I always surrender when I bleed. But I'm learning to surrender through this process before I have to bleed. Everybody says we grow through pain, and that's for sure. But there comes a time in the program where there's a way to grow without it having to be so damn painful before we start. I grew up in a little town in Western Kentucky named Mayfield. I grew up in a home where there was no alcohol, no drugs. My grandfather died drinking lye water in the Mayfield City Jail. He was a town drunk. My mother was molested physically, emotionally, and sexually in that home. She was what we know as a true adult child of an alcoholic. Now, I'm not going to get into an issue whether you believe that exists or not, but I will tell you for sure that the big book tells us if you're around one of us, you get goofy. Well, it says you get neurotic. I call it goofy, but it's the same deal. You get neurotic. And my mother was neurotic. My mother's one of the lovingest, most beautiful people I've ever known. But my mother was scarred almost beyond reprieve. And she dragged that whole alcoholism into our family. They had an interesting way of treating alcoholics in the middle 30s in Mayfield. When my grandfather got drunk, they put him in jail. When he got sober, they put him in a chain gang, sweeping the Mayfield City streets. And my mother used to walk past her daddy at least once a week, sweeping the Mayfield City streets. You know, that big red letter was alcohol, not adultery. And she wore that red letter to the day she died of untreated alcoholism. Never took a drink. Had to take some pills, but never took a drink. And in our home, I recognized that came out kind of interesting. When I was perfect, Mother would talk to me. When I wasn't perfect, she wouldn't talk to me. So what did I do? I became perfect, didn't I? And if you'd ever known me in high school and college, you'd have thought, this is the most perfect kid you've ever known, because by God, I was. I mean, I was a neat kid. I remember when I was a senior in high school, getting ready to go to college, I was laying in the bed the night before I was due to leave to go to college, and I said, God, I thank you for all the things you've given me. If I ever have a son, I want him to be just like me. Be careful what you pray for. You may get it, because that's just what I got. As a matter of fact, that boy is talking at an AA conference tonight. and I'm real grateful that he is. And he does a hell of a job. In fact, more and more in Louisville, I'm getting to be known as Burns' daddy. That's kind of interesting. I had to deal with that for a while, you know. I always thought he was Burns Jr., Burns Sr.'s son, and now I'm his dad. But I went to college. There was no problem. Got into medical school. Now, I don't know about all y'all, but I've always had a motor running in me. Get there, get to me, get to C, get to D. What you been saying? Get ready. Red light, green light, green light, noise. Y'all ever had that going on in your noises like that? Just a constant motor running, just like that. See, what medical science says is we have ADD, attention deficit disorder. It says we have affective disorders, mood disorders. 70-90% of us do. 50-70% of male alcoholics have attention deficit disorder. Big Book says we're irritable, restless, and discontented, you know. But I'm a typical ADD. I'm irritable, restless, discontented. That damn noise is going in me all the time. Pow, 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 pow. And I mean, I didn't think I could study. I didn't think I could sleep. I couldn't. And I just couldn't eat. I just got all packed up, ready to go home. 1 month, a friend of mine came up and gave me this little capsule called amphetamine. Speed. I took that sucker and that motor stopped. Just like that, it stopped. I found four things that'll stop my motor. Amphetamine, alcohol, sex, and Alcoholics Anonymous. AA works better, it just takes a little longer. And I haven't been put in jail one time for going to AA meetings. But I got put in jail for every one of those others. I did not know that was a policewoman. I thought $50 was worth it, you know. But I only did it once. I won't tell no, I only did it once, you know. Like telling your daddy you only had one beer. I only did it once. Yes, sir. It stopped that motor, and I thought I'd found the answer, and I was hooked on that sucker immediately. I took it for 4 years, got kicked out of medical school 2 weeks before graduation my senior year. I beat up one of my medicine professors. He took me to the head of the department of psychiatry, and Dr. Keller said, "What's wrong with you?" And I said, "I take too many drugs." And he said, "Do you believe that?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I do." And he said, "We can help you." And I said, "What are you going to do?" And he said, "We're going to put you in intensive psychiatric therapy. If you can figure out why you take that drug, you can quit. If you figure out why you take that drug, you can quit. You hear it? That's called thinking yourself into a way of acting, isn't it? That's cognitive cause and effect living. It works beautifully for daily living. If you don't want to get hit by a bus, don't step out in front of one. If you don't want to get rabies, don't play with a rabid dog. It just works beautifully for daily living. It won't work to treat alcoholism. Because when we first come into recovery, we got sawdust for brains. And that's real. It's now called the post-acute recovery syndrome. You look at what Wilson said in his story. He said he couldn't get a job for a year and a half because he was racked with waves of self-pity and resentment. He was describing the post-acute recovery syndrome. What we know today, medical science in 79 said the alcoholic will lose short-term memory for 6 months to 2 years. Simple problem solving and stress management. Sleep patterns will be messed up. 6 months to 2 years. We got sawdust for brains. And we can't think ourselves into a way of acting. I love that slogan that says, think, think, think. And I'm saying, well, how do you spell it? How do you spell it? Think, think, think. Sawdust for brains. Now, they're going to have me think myself into a way of acting. A year and a half, I was in intensive psychiatric therapy, working my little butt off, and I was doing it. Didn't take any amphetamine. After a year and a half, they said, "You ready to go back into medical school?" And I said, "I think so." They said, "How do you feel?" And I said, "I'm scared to death." And they said, "Why are you scared?" And I said, "Because they're going to be watching me." They said, "Why should they be watching?" "Because I whipped one of them." "Well, then they should be watching you because you whipped one, and you ought to be afraid because they're watching you." Now, that's a reasonable thing for them to do, and it's a reasonable way for you to feel. Now, you can own the feeling. The feeling won't have to own you. Go on in there. You won't have to take drugs. And I thought, hallelujah, here we go. And I was in there ready to go. Within 30 minutes, I was strung out on amphetamine. I just sat down and cried because I didn't know why. Let me tell you what, and I want you to think about this. What they did for me in that year and a half to 2 years was take me through the equivalent of the first 5 steps. I want you to think about it. Because I knew I couldn't take amphetamine. They led me through a total inventory. I was able to tell my feelings and share with that psychiatrist who was very spiritually based. But where AA for me goes to the fourth dimension begins at step 6. That's where it separates the men from the boys. That's what the book says, isn't it? Separates the men from the boys, the whole fourth dimension. And they hadn't taken me there. Nor did they think they could. Nor did they say they would. My classmates enabled me. When I'd get too hot, they'd take me home. They'd put me to bed. I was married, had one small child. My wife would call the medical school and tell them I had the flu. Hell, I had the flu 20 or 30 times that year. They knew better, but they didn't know what to do with me. They'd given it their best shot. 1964, I graduated from medical school. And between 1964 and 1967, I was in a mental hospital four times, strapped down, IV fluid, straitjacket, padded cells. I might stay off amphetamine 6 hours, 6 days, 6 weeks, 6 months. I always went back, always put me in a mental hospital. 1967, I joined the Army. I was strung out on amphetamine. I was in the doctor's lounge. The Vietnam War was going on. And I was raising hell about the inequality or inequities of the Vietnam War. And I was just raising hell. And finally, one of the guys said, "If you believe it that strong, why don't you join?" I said, "By God, I will." I walked out and joined the Army. Didn't call my wife, didn't do anything. Just went to Frankfurt and joined. Came home and I said, "Pack the clothes. We're going to the Army." "Where are we sending you?" "I don't know. As soon as they send us, we're gone, because I'm going to straighten this damn war out." Yeah. When my wife divorced me, she gave 100 reasons, and that was 2, 7, 8, and 12 for the reason she divorced me. She should have made it 1, 2, and 3, you know. That's the way I was. They put me in charge of the dispensary, gave me the only key to the pharmacy. It's like putting a fox in a chicken house, isn't it? After a year, the post commander came down, and he said, "Are you taking the amphetamine?" And I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "If you don't quit, we're going to put you in Leavenworth." So I quit. Once he explained it to me, I quit. But the deal was I could still quit. Came home in 69, had my gallbladder out. They attributed that to the amphetamine partially. Two members of the board of licensure, my internist and surgeon came down, sat by the bed, held my hand, and they prayed and said, "Dear God, please help him overcome this amphetamine. He's a good doctor and a good man." So I quit taking amphetamine somewhere between 1969 and 1970. That's my last amphetamine. I didn't really give it a chance to know if I was tired of this or didn't think much about it. I got tired of all the consequences, so it was easy enough to quit. The reason it was easy enough to quit is because I started drinking. Drinking hadn't been a problem. First 4 years of my drinking, wasn't an alcoholic. I might get drunk, I might stay sober. My wife wasn't too pleased with my performance, but hell, she wasn't pleased before that. She hadn't. The self-centeredness was more manifest than even the drugs. Next 3 years of my drinking was alcoholic. Every minute of every day was alcohol. When's my next drink? How much will it be? How much will I drink? How will it affect me? Every minute of every day. If you didn't drink, we didn't run together. If restaurants didn't serve alcohol, I didn't go. Every minute. I left that office at 4 o'clock. If you were in the stirrups, my partner had to examine you because my butt was out of there at 4 o'clock because my first drink was going to be 4:15 and that was it. The last year of my drinking, I drank addictively. I drank a quart of whiskey a night. Told myself I wasn't an alcoholic because I never drank in my office. Had to believe it, didn't I? I didn't have a choice. My wife got rid of me in 1975. It took her 17 years to get up enough courage to kick me out. Took me 17 years to drink enough whiskey to be able to leave. Kind of a mutual type deal. She loved taking care of me, and I loved being taken care of. We hated each other's guts. But finally, I pushed her to the point where she kicked me out of the house. You know, all alcoholics, when they force someone to do something to them as they're walking out the door, they say, "Oh, I'll leave. It's your fault. You're kicking me out." You know, we do it beautifully, but we always manage, don't we? So I ran around saying what a horse's ass she was. She kicked me out of the house, but didn't bought me a sports car and ran around and womanized and did all those kind of things. Tried to act like a grown-up when there's a scared little boy running around all the time. Now I met Casey, one of the neatest people and one of God's greatest gifts to me. And I knew I had something special. We moved in together, and divorce took a long time to overcome. The more I was with her, the more I knew she was special. And I thought, if I don't quit drinking, I'll run her off like I've run everybody else off. My drink of choice was scotch and water, so I switched to beer, and it bloated me and made me pee. I switched to wine, and it was too sugary. It made me sick. One night I drank 24 martinis and couldn't get drunk. The next day I drank a beer and couldn't walk for 3 days. You know, that's alcoholism. Somewhere between Thanksgiving and December 1st, 1977, Casey had gone to work, and I got up that morning, and I was sitting in the chair. And I thought, well, I can't drink whiskey, and I can't take amphetamine, so I'll smoke dope. I thought, well, you can't smoke dope. None of this stuff works in you. You know it doesn't work in you. And I thought, well, then I won't do anything. I thought, you don't know how not to do anything. and reach that point where you can't live with it, you can't live without it. That moment of complete hopelessness and helplessness that I hope every alcoholic gets to. I looked out that window and this gets real personal. I said, God, please help me. And I became aware of what I had to do, and the peace was immeasurable. And I walked into the bedroom, took out my 12-gauge shotgun, and put it in my mouth. Because I was going to die. And I was real happy about that. I wasn't scared of dying. I was terrified of living. Didn't know how. I've had people say, you think your God led you in there to that shotgun? And I said, I don't have a doubt in my mind. I said, my God led me to that moment of truth that every alcoholic will reach, and he was so good to me, he led me to it then. Every alcoholic is going to have to ask himself or herself the question, do you want to live or do you want to die? You can choose to blow the back of your head out, or you can choose to wait till your liver's down on your iliac crest, and your eyes are yellow as a gourd, and your belly's the size of a pumpkin, and your arms and legs are the size of matchsticks. But you'll die. 100% of the time. I worked at the University of Louisville School of Medicine, among other things. 50% of alcoholics die as a direct result of their drinking. The other 50% die of getting run over, getting killed, getting stabbed, shooting themselves, homicide, suicide, the whole deal. 95%. It's a major trauma center, and 95% of that trauma center is occupied every day with a victim of alcoholism and drug abuse. 95%. My God said, it's your call, boy. It's your call. I'll give you everything you need, but it's your call. You want to live, or you want to die? I'm going to tell you something else. God is so good to us that he has allowed the insurance companies to quit paying for treatment. And you know why? Oh, this is real opinionated. You don't have to agree with it, but I really don't give a shit. But I'm going to tell you exactly what I think. He stopped the whole treatment industry because he knows it's time to send the drunks home. And we're going to have to be ready. They're still going to detox them for us, thank God. Because 85% of alcoholics who quit drinking abruptly go into DTs, and 15% of those people die. So they're still going to detox them, but they're going to send them home, aren't they? You know what our job is? Is to be ready for the message that newcomer is going to hear. How many times have I been asked, how do you make a 12-step call? It's fascinating. You read the directions. You read the directions. And we're going to have to be ready because thank God they're coming home. And we're going to be there. Ready. They ain't going to have to worry about whether or not their therapist told them a certain thing, and I'm not anti-therapy because I've had a lot of good therapy. They're going to be worrying about how to work 12 steps and have a spiritual awakening if we do our job. I called to the phone. I became aware of the fact that I wanted to live. Now, let me tell you something. This is why it's so special to me about Wilson deciding about all those alcoholics who may not hear. When I sat on the side of that bed and made the decision not to pull that trigger, it had nothing to do with my wanting to live. It had everything in the world with my not wanting my children to know their daddy died that way. It had everything in the world with not wanting Casey to walk in that room and find my brains on the wall. At the moment of truth, I was able to reach down inside from that 12 years in the Baptist church with a string of metals down my chest and a wonderful home that was full of love, goofy as hell, but full of love, and have enough dignity to think about my children and my baby. And say, I will not put them through this. But then I just screamed because inside I knew I didn't have a clue. And I called the phone and asked for help. A good friend of mine, I met him in his office, said, David, please help me. He sent me to a psych hospital in New York. He sent me there because as I was talking to him, he said, Burns, how do you feel? And I said, David, I'm depressed. He said, well, if you drank as much whiskey as you drink, you ought to be depressed. I said, no, you don't understand. I'm depressed, and therefore I drink. He said, no, you drink, therefore you're depressed. I said, no, you're wrong. I'm depressed, and I drink. He said, no, you drink, and you're depressed. And we got locked in this deal. I was going to go anywhere he sent me, but he said, I couldn't budge you from the fact that your primary problem was drinking, and your secondary problem was depression, secondary to the drinking. And the wonderful statistic we know in recovery today is 60% of depression, 100% of alcoholics are depressed when they come in here. 60% will clear within the first 4 weeks just getting them off the booze. Another 30% will clear within 1 year just giving them a way to live. And the next 2% will clear in the next year when they figure out they're going to do it. So we're left with 8% of the people who are going to need medication. And the deal is you can't separate the fly shit from the pepper at 1 week in this program. You can't separate it 1 year in this program. What you do is you establish them from not drinking and not taking drugs, and you're going to find out what you got. And then those people who need pills are going to take them. But you're going to need somebody like me who's a specialist in this field, and you got them around you. A doctor who knows alcoholism, so he can make the right call. We talk about dual diagnosis and kid about it sometimes. One of the reasons that I'm one of the most revered physicians in this country by some and hated by some is that I don't even make a dual diagnosis for the first 2 years. Unless there's a psychotic break. Unless somebody goes goofier than a goat.
Goofier than we are for the first 2 years, you know, if you're like me, anyway. Like, where's my car? Where's my fire? Where's my bed? You know, where's my stethoscope?
But those people will clear up. But he couldn't jar me, so he sent me to this psych hospital, and he told me he sent me there because he wanted them to scare the hell out of me. And they did that. They did that. I checked in. They didn't believe in detox. And they gave me this plate, and it's a plastic plate, and I'd put it through this little slit in the wall. And when I put my plate through that little slit in the wall, they'd put my food on that plate. And I'd pull that sucker out, and they'd give me a plastic utensil. And the idiots always put peas on my plate. And I had figured out that, and looking through that wall, I saw this mirror. And to this day, I know, I've been in medical schools. That's a mirror they're watching, you see. And they figure as soon as I can get all those plates, all those peas on that fork, they're going to let me out of that damn unit, you know. So I figured out I'd take those peas and put them on one at a time on my fork. Then I had a problem getting it to my mouth. But you know, I'm telling you, I was right, because as soon as I got all those peas in my mouth, they let me out of that room. And to this day, I still think it was the original pea test. But I knew 5-6 days into that thing, I was trying to find my roommate, or 9 days, I was trying to find my roommate, and I couldn't find him. I went and opened the closet, and there he was, hanging in the closet. And I sat down on the bed, and all I could think, I remember sitting there looking at him, and I thought, I wonder who I'm going to get to play ping pong with. And I thought, man, that's not appropriate. That's not appropriate. And I dropped on my knees, and I said, God, what am I? And I felt that voice we all fear, that we all feel. Said, you're an alcoholic. Went to the phone call. David, he sent me to an alcohol treatment center in Atlanta. I stayed 3 months, came back home, and I was ready. Wasn't negotiating, wasn't manipulating, wasn't trying to do anything except follow directions. And I walked into you people, and I said, what have I got to do to stay sober? And you said, you do anything we tell you to do. You're going to act yourself into a way of thinking. You're going to act yourself into a way of thinking. I said, what do you want me to do? He said, don't drink. Go to meetings. Oh, you might ought to read the big book, but don't drink and go to meetings. I thought, all they do is talk about don't drink. Don't drink. Don't drink. Don't drink. Hell, they just beat it to death. I know that. Put on a tape of Sandy Beaches, and he said every time he got drunk, it was a direct result of drinking. I thought, well, hell, he's figured this whole thing out. This man's a genius. Because I had all that victimization I've talked about, you know. No, I said, don't get drunk. Don't drink. And then about meetings. Let me share with you 18 years of meetings. When I first started going to meetings, I found out real quick that this is a perfect program composed of an awful lot of goofy people in varying degrees of goofiness. There are some absolute spiritual giants, and quite honestly, I include myself in that today. Not necessarily because of my size, but because I do walk with my God every moment of every day. Sometimes we're arguing, and sometimes I say, get behind me, because I'm going to do what I want to do. But I know He's there, that wonderful power of love. But in the process of getting there, I was just as goofy as many of y'all are. And I had to separate the principles and the personalities. When we first came in, there were people hitting on my wife. Now, some of y'all know my wife. You understand why there'd be people hitting on my wife. I didn't like it, but at least I understood it. But there were people hitting on me, and I didn't understand that at all, because I looked like the wrath of God. I had acne, had that big belly, little skinny arms and legs. I had a look on my face like if somebody says, boo, I'll string it from here to the next wall, you know, that kind of deal. I didn't even want to sleep with me. Even my right hand was dodging. I used to think that was a joke until I realized that was the truth. You know, that was absolutely the truth. So I found out real quick, you separate the principles and the personalities. And today, on a daily basis, it's still absolutely essential for me to separate the principles and the personalities in AA. People wanted to borrow money, and they didn't pay it back, and they didn't. Then I began to look for people, and I'd say, why do you want to take me out to coffee? They'd say, because we want to stay sober. We want to help you stay sober. And I found the winner. Please, for the newcomer, do not confuse the principles and the personalities. Even my first 8 years of recovery was a personality recovery. Sponsors are just exactly what you are. They're a drunk who's just been around a little longer. They're essential in my life. I will never, God willing, I'm sure He is, be without a sponsor. But a sponsor is a personality. The principles of this program are perfect. The personalities are not. Don't confuse them. And for God's sake, don't use them as an excuse to quit going to meetings, because that's almost certainly going to get you drunk. Because I found out them that don't go to meetings don't hear what happens to them that don't go to meetings. You know? And when I became a student of this book, I also, in reading the book, found out something really interesting. And there is a solution that says, there will come a day when we'll be unable to bring into our conscious memory with sufficient force the humiliation of a week or a month ago. We forget. When I'm talking to these doctors, I put all these equations on the board. They're what Silkworth said, a physical allergy and mental obsession, but we have lots of equations. And when I get through, they said, well, is that alcoholism? I say, that's alcoholism. They say, why do y'all ever drink again? I say, because we forgot what happened to us the last time we took a drink. They say, oh, it can't be that simple. Sit in an AA meeting. Ask someone to quit going to meetings. They forget. Isn't it wonderful that God loves us so much that He gives us selective memory for all that pain? And isn't it even more wonderful that God loves us so much He gave us a program where every time we walk into a meeting, we remember the pain, but we have a way to deal with it so that we don't forget? You know, by the grace of God, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, everything that means, the meetings, a sponsor, the big book, a home group, the whole deal, finding a God of my understanding, y'all have helped me know who I am. When I walk in that back door, I'm reminded of what I am. And if I forget what I am, I'm going to lose who I am, and you can take that to the bank. I'm really grateful to be Burns Brady. But even if I forget my name, I'm even more grateful that I'm an alcoholic. And I hope to God I never forget it, but I will unless I go to meetings. Then I asked God to show me a burning bush. I used to lay on the floor listening to my records. I don't know about y'all, but I had these two records I played every time when I came home to drink. First was the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, the Philadelphia Philharmonic Orchestra doing the Battle Hymn of the Republic. And I'd listen to that sucker, and I'd stand there and drink and cry and march. Then I'd put on Neil Diamond's I Am, I Cried. And I'd put that sucker on. He'd say, I am, I cried. And I'd go, oh, God, Neil, I know what you mean, you know. Then I'd sit there on the floor and I'd say, God, just show me a burning bush. Hell, what does Moses have I don't have? Just one burning bush is all I want, you know. And you know where He sent me? He sent me to AA. And for those of you who have ever had the privilege of sitting here and watching, you see the burning bushes, and the glow is incredible. It doesn't take me but a second to see the burning bushes. Then I go to a lot of meetings because that's where my friends are,
And finally, I go to a lot of meetings because I want you to tell me what you're going to do between tonight and tomorrow night, the next meeting you go to. It ain't too hard to sit in an AA meeting and be halfway straight. Even goofy in the first early part of recovery. I sponsored a guy one time, he said, "Burns, I'm going to 6 meetings a day." And I said, "Okay, let's look at that. You go to 6 meetings a day, that's 6 hours. You subtract 6 hours from 24, that's 18. That means if you sleep 12 hours, you got 6 hours left. Let's give you an hour for travel time, that's 5 hours you got." And I said, "Hell, I can screw up half the free world in 5 hours. So what are you going to do between this meeting and the next meeting?" Don't drink, go to meetings and read the big book. Got the big book down, I think that's beautiful, and close that sucker. Couldn't remember it. I'd open it and read it, couldn't close it, couldn't remember it. Pick up my meditation book and read it and close it, couldn't remember. Finally, I pick up the Courage Journal and close it, couldn't remember. I walk into the meeting, I say, I can't remember anything. You say, "Hell, don't worry about it, none of us can." I say, "Oh God, how long will it last?" "About 6 months, 10 years. "Oh God," I'll come in the next night, couldn't remember. I say, "I can't remember anything because I forgot what you told me the night before." You know, I used to lose my car drunk all the time. I lost my car for a year sober. I drive my car to work and park it, go in practice medicine, get my car, got on home, drive, practice medicine, go to Casey's car, parked it, went in, practice medicine, came out, couldn't find my car. This is in the first year. Started crying. I cried a lot in the first year. Went in, got my partner, said, "Somebody stole my car," and he came out and said, "Burns, you drove Casey's car." And I said, "Oh God, that's right, I drove Casey's car." So they assigned me a parking space. And they said, "When Burns leaves the office, he's going to that parking space. If he gets whatever's in it started, he's going to drive it home." And I thought, well, if I can't remember anything, it won't work. I wonder how it works. Oh, God, how does it work? And finally, I remember when you read how it works, I'm getting better. So I got it down there. It was first paragraph. Honesty, honesty, honesty. 3 times. Anybody can make a thing, be honest. And really what it says is nobody can make it if they can't. One thing if you want to take away from here tonight. You can't get sober if you don't stay honest. Because if you can't stay honest, you're going to drink. My credo came, don't drink, go to meetings, don't tell lies. When I went into treatment drinking a quart of whiskey a night and begged to go into treatment, sitting in front of the guy running the treatment center, he looked at me and said, "Burns, how much do you drink?" And I said, "I drink a 6-pack of beer every night." He says, "You're lying." And I said, "I know what I do it all the time. Why do I do that?" I'd play golf and hit my ball up on the green. I'd go up there and I'd put a dime in front of that ball, come back and put that ball in front of that dime, just save myself a fourth of an inch on a 40-foot putt, and I hated my guts, just hated my guts for doing that. That first summer I came back, hit that ball on that green, go up there and put that dime behind that ball, put that ball down in front of that dime, and I'd walk off that green feeling good about me. I couldn't find my golf cart, but I'd walk off that green feeling real good. I really did lose one in the creek one time, swear to God I did. Feeling good about me. And the word was, you ask Burns Brady and he'll tell you the truth. May not have anything to do with what you're talking about, but he'll tell you the truth. And I mean to tell you, honesty was everything to me. Today someone hears that story and they say, that's cash register honesty. I want to tell you, bet your ass it's cash register honesty. And we shortchange it too much. Most of the people I work with who get drunk over being dishonest get drunk over being dishonest when they know they're lying. They know they're lying. See, you say you got to be honest with myself. Oh, I don't have a bit of problem with that as a principle. Let me tell you the problem I have with it in truth. If I can lie to me in a heartbeat because of the peculiar mental twist and never know it. And that's why I've got everything you taught me to have, the things I've outlined, a sponsor, a home group, every one of those things, so that those people can help me be honest with me. But I'll guarantee you the big deal is for me to know that I'm being honest and to be with you so you can help me work out the small stuff, because the small stuff gets to be the big stuff. Alcohol is subtle. That's in the 10th step, isn't it? Alcohol is subtle. We're not cured of our alcoholism. What we have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of your spiritual condition. Sit down to that when you get home and write down the way alcohol is subtle for you, how it's subtle. I've watched it in me at this conference. Because it fascinates me to see the subtlety and the delusion of alcohol. To watch it play in my mind to where I can take 2 and 2 and make it 6. God knows my Achilles heels, and by the grace of God in your work, I know my Achilles heel. And it may smell like a woman, but I'm going to tell you what, for all you guys, it's going to taste like whiskey. And until you can learn to deal with a relationship where there is a relationship based on trust and communication and honesty and love,
Every man I've worked with that relapses, damn near always relapses through a relationship because they can't be honest and says, I don't work with women. Because for the problems I got, I don't need to be working with women. I mean, I may be having some wonderful stuff to tell them, but by the time I'm halfway through the sermon, I done forgot what my original reason was for being there. You say, man, you done told me more than I want to hear, but there's some people out there that may need to hear that too, because, I mean, that's real. I only got one marching order for a woman to take care of me and make me feel happy, you know. My wife one day told me she wasn't playing that game anymore, and I decided to get me another woman. That led to a hell of a fist fight, and it took me almost 4 years to get over that. Not because of her, but because of me. I do want to say one thing about the big book. I'm the addictionologist for a 200-man treatment center. Now, I run the Kentucky Impaired Physicians Program. Practiced medicine for 25 years. In 1992, I left that to run the Impaired Physicians Program for the state of Kentucky. Working with doctors is like shooting fish in a barrel. It ain't no real problem. You just spell out what they can lose, and most of them will follow, and they will surrender. It takes about 4 or 5 years, but they'll make it. But as the addictionologist for a 200-man treatment center, what we show them is what they can become. We sleep 200 men a day, and we have 90 men in a dynamic of recovery, a recovery dynamics big book study, going to AA meetings every night. We got a 40-man non-medical detox. We just started a 25-man, a 25-woman homeless shelter. Same principle. And we bring those men in right after their detox. I mean, tell you, we lead them across the street, and the first day they got that book in their hand, and they got somebody teaching them that book. And we got 200 people, by the grace of God and with His help, sober after 2 years off the street. They told us it was an untreatable population. And they're studying that book from day one. And when I hear someone say, you can't take a full step for a year because you have to wait till your memory clears up. Bullshit. Now, if you don't hear my point, you want me to go back over it again, or did I make it real firm? The message that the newcomer is going to hear, please, please, God, hear me. They may not remember what they read, but have them doing it. You say, is that my opinion? No. After 2 years, figure up how many street people we've worked with. And these people can assimilate and use the big book in a very few months. And use it well. We're a godsend our entire community because they're bringing into our communities an awareness of the fundamentals and the simplicity of Alcoholics Anonymous. First year of my recovery was crazy as hell. The night I got my token, I cried through the whole thing. Second year was a little bit better, and by the end of the second year, I had cleared up and I became Little Mr. Perfect AA. Get up on time, eat your breakfast, do your meditation, get to the office, call your sponsor, call your wife, eat your lunch, see your patients at home in the evening, greet your wife, kiss your wife, eat your supper, get to the meeting 30 minutes early, set up the ashtray, set up the coffee, greet the newcomer, give him your telephone number, say 30 minutes late, come 30 minutes early, get home in the evening, call your sponsor, talk to your wife, pray with your wife, make love to your wife, go to sleep, bum, 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 Little Mr. Perfect AA. Is that fit for any of y'all? Little Mr. Perfect. 5 years in the program, I'm just like this, and the old timers would say, how are you doing, Burns? I say, I'm fine. This is a smile, you idiot. And I'm down in South Georgia at Thomasville visiting an Episcopal priest who was my first spiritual director. We don't talk about him much anymore. And I was visiting Jimmy, 5 years sober, came back to the motel, dropped on my knees, and I said, God, please help me. Casey put her hands on my shoulders and said, call your sponsor. I called Jim, and my first sponsor has a two-step program. I'm going to tell you that because I'm going to tell you what he told me. I said, Jim, I'm flying apart. He said, do you believe you're going to get this program? I said, I don't know. He said, when you get home, we'll talk about it. Started to hang up, and he said, don't hang up. Do you believe if you work these steps perfectly, it'll make you good? And I said, yeah. He said, you're wrong. He said, do you believe if you get drunk, it'll make you bad? And I said, yeah. He said, you're wrong. I said, what's the story? He said, Burns, you've been trying to buy something that isn't for sale. God loves you just the way you are. You can't earn it, and you can't give it away. You can't just kick it away. God loves you. He'll love you in the wrong bed. He'll love you drunk. He'll love you sober. He just loves you. You'll feel better about yourself if you do the right thing. But He loves you. And for me, that's what I needed to hear. That God loves me just the way I am. I tried to be perfect for Mama and she couldn't handle it. I tried to be perfect for me and I couldn't do it. I tried to be perfect for God and He didn't need it. My whole life changed. It's never been the same. I don't have to ask. This is very personal. You don't have to agree with this. I don't have to ask my God for forgiveness. My God never judges me. I ask Him to help me forgive myself. And for that day, walk with Him in my life. I had to go through the next 4 years of working on being able to love unconditionally. It was very difficult. I did not know how. I almost left my wife at 8.5 years because all Casey wanted to do was go to school, go to her own meetings, and go into therapy. And what I heard was, she's leaving. She said, I've never loved you more, Burns, but I want to do these things. And my thought was, get another woman. I went to my sponsor and I said, I don't have to put up this. I'll just get another woman. He said, if you don't change your attitudes, you'll run this one off just like you run every one of the others off. And I didn't know what to do. A little pigeon of mine with 7 months sobriety came up and gave me 8 tapes. And they were Joe and Charlie's tapes in the Big Book. As I listened to those tapes, I knew the program I didn't have. Had 12 copies made. 12 of us got together and began to study and do that book, and my whole life changed. That marriage was almost destroyed. Three years ago, we went into therapy. I need to say this. I stood at this podium in this Wiggle Roundup in 1988. And I said, the day you ever see Burns Brady in therapy again will be the day hell will freeze over. Well, I want y'all to get your ice skates because we're going to do a little ice skating, folks. With a very powerful spiritual program of my own and Casey with a very powerful spiritual program and two very good people, we went into marriage counseling 3 years ago. And I'm going to tell you, our marriage is stronger and better today than it's ever been. And I heard in this town, in 1988, a woman stand behind the podium and say, the Al-Anon speaker, when she came in AA, or her husband came in AA, she went to Al-Anon. He worked on his program, she worked on hers, they never worked on theirs. And 14 years later, they got a divorce. And I need to tell you from my own experience, if you're in a relationship, and he's got his program, and she's got her program, and you're not looking at y'all's relationship. If you just think your own spiritual program's going to do it, it may in many instances, but there may be a reason and a need at times to have some real help. And my wife and I needed it, and it saved our lives, and it saved our relationship. And I'm deeply grateful for it. I'm deeply grateful for it. And there was another big guru speaker at that conference, a real guru speaker, who got up the next night and said, Burns, that's one of the finest AA talks I've ever heard. Because I'd said at that time that some people were advising me to go into therapy, but I wasn't going to do it. He said, I agree with you. If you know the first 164 pages of the Big Book, nobody needs to go into therapy. And after it was over, I went up to him and I said, I don't have a resentment about what you're saying, but I think it's irresponsible. Because I don't know what everybody out in that room needs. And I know that our program is very, very encompassing and says if we need it, we get it. I go to 5 meetings a week and I work with alcoholics and love it. And the therapy saved our marriage because we took a good spiritual program in and God gave us the tools. And to leave that out is to leave out a significant part of my recovery. You've been very patient and I want to tell you a couple of stories. One has to do with my daughter. My daughter 15 years ago sat straddling my chest and tried to kill me. I was drunk. She was stoned on amphetamine, Darvon, Valium. No, it was 19 years ago. And she didn't kill me because it was an automatic shotgun. She couldn't load it. 14 years ago, Libby came in AA.
About 3 years ago, I was off at a conference. It was Father's Day and my birthday, and I came home, and there were balloons above the garage and above the door. I turned them around and said to the world's greatest dad, happy birthday on Father's Day and on your birthday. Libby got married 5 years ago and asked me to give her away. She got divorced last year, and guess who she came to talk with almost every night to talk about the spiritual process to deal with that divorce appropriately? It was her daddy. My son came in AA 10 years ago, that's about right. He was 16 years old when he started, was drinking real bad, and he lived with his mother, and he sold all of her jewelry one piece at a time and all of her silverware one piece at a time. She ignored that, and then one day he sold her car, and she couldn't ignore that. So she put him in jail. When he got out of jail, he came to want to live with us. When he came in, I'd spent a year getting prepared for this because I knew that boy was coming. And I wanted to do what was right for him, but everything in me wanted to take care of him, wanted to take care of him and whatnot, and he came in, but I had to deliver the message. Came in and said, Daddy, I want to live with y'all. Mama won't let me live with her. I said, if you get some help for your alcoholism, we'll talk about it. He said, I'm not an alcoholic. And I said, if you want to live in my home, that's your call. You want to live on the streets, that's yours. Kathy said, and Kathy knows how much I love her, and Casey and Kathy are very close. Kathy said today she doesn't have to accept unacceptable behavior, and neither does anybody. And that boy couldn't live in my home and drink. Just the way it was. He said, screw you, and walked out. For 4 months, he was on the street. Finally came back and said, Daddy, please get me help. We got him help. About 3 years later, we were in an AA meeting, and a woman said her son went off to camp with two boys, and it caught them smoking dope. And she knew her son was smoking dope. What did she do to help him? A bunch of us talked. Finally, my boy raised his hand and said, I don't know what you can do to help him, but I'll tell you what turned my life around. It was my daddy. So when he was drinking, he'd come in and slap mother. Then he'd come up and whip us. So I hated his guts. So the mother kicked him out of the house, and he's still drinking. He'd call and say he'd come get us, and he wouldn't come get us. So he got in AA, and he came and told Mama he was sorry and paid her money that he owed her. And when he told us he was coming, he was always there. And when I was on those streets, I knew I wanted to grow up to be just like my daddy. Final story is my daddy. My mama died in 1978 of metastatic breast cancer. I had about 8 months to go down and make my amends to Daddy and to Mother, and we did that. Daddy, about a year later, Daddy's kind of like me. Daddy had a hard time taking care of himself without a woman in his life. It's like Daddy never could. One of the finest men I ever knew. Daddy never would say, I love you, but he was always there for me. And I always wanted Daddy to tell me he loved me. He never would, but he's just always there for me. I went down to make my amends to him. He wouldn't talk to me about it. And y'all taught me I couldn't shove it down his throat. He met a beautiful woman, a lovely woman, who was a member of the church where he went, and they got married, and one of God's greatest gifts. And about 5 years after that, Daddy started to lose his mind. First, he forgot who I was, and then he forgot who my brother was, and then he forgot that Mother had ever been alive. Had to put him in a nursing home, and that was very painful. That's where he needed to be. Every Sunday, I'd drive down and park in that parking lot, and I'd say, Dear God, please take away my pain. I'd go in there, and Daddy wouldn't recognize me, didn't react to me. I'd just get in the car and go home, cry all the way back. One Sunday, I drove in and I parked. I said, Dear God, let me be for my daddy what you want me to be. Went in, I didn't call him Daddy. That confused him. He was sitting in a wheelchair. I said, How can I help you? He said, Yeah, Buster. He thought I was his brother, Buster, my uncle. I said, would you shave me? I shaved Daddy. I said, how would you like some lunch? He said, yeah, I believe I would. And I rolled him in there and got his food and fed him because he was too weak to feed himself. Peggy came in and sat down, and she and I got to talking, and Daddy was sitting there watching us. Mama and I had done that for years, to sit there and talk. Daddy used to love to watch Mama and me talk. We'd just talk, and we'd just watch. He never would say anything. I said, how would you like to go out on the porch? He said, yeah, and I rolled it out on the porch. And Peggy and I got to talking again, just talking and talking. He's sitting in a wheelchair. He raised up in that wheelchair and looked me right in the face. He said, son, the way you just like the little boy your mama and I raised. I love you very much. Thank you for coming to see me. The miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous is not that my daddy recognized me. The miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous is that this self-centered alcoholic said, Dear God, let me be for my daddy what you want me to be.
Alcoholics Anonymous is a language of the heart. We feel without touching, we hear without talking, and we love by instinct. For the next few minutes, in the quietness of this room and the safety of being with each other and loving each other, I want you to feel the language of the heart. Whoever talk that I've ever given the same way. When I couldn't walk talking to you, gum, I used to listen to Father Martin tapes. He had a tape called The 12 Steps. He closed that tape in a way which says what I like to say to y'all. You people will be in my thoughts frequently, you'll be in my heart, and you'll be in my prayers always. I love you very much. I thank you for loving me. I thank you for letting me come and talk with you. Most of all, I thank you for the message in these rooms that gave me and mine our lives. For those people that I'm seeing again, it's good to see you. For those people I've met for the first time, I'm grateful to have you in my life. For those people I haven't met, we will meet as we tread this road of happy destiny. Let's try to do it at God's speed. It works better. Good night. Thank you very much.